sky for you and I. I know we're all blues, all shades, all hues, all blues. Some blues are sad, but some are glad. The moan of pain and a taste of strife and a sad refrain, a game which life is playing. Blues can be the living dues we're all paying. Yeah, oh Lord.
That's the marvelous Ernestine Anderson, still going strong at 85 with All Blues from her 1983 album, Big City. That was composed by Miles Davis and lyrics written by Oscar Brown Jr. Here in this song, she's accompanied by Hank Jones on piano, Monty Budwig on bass, and Jeff Hamilton on drums. I could listen to her all day long. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, July the 3rd. And I'm picking up from where I left off yesterday, talking about the Civil Rights Act of 1964. We began our discussion yesterday, as I said. It was the 50th anniversary of the signing of the legislation into law by President Lyndon Baines Johnson. And, of course, it came after waves and waves and waves of protest and demonstrations and advocacy about this central question about what exactly are citizens entitled to in terms of their rights. And these citizens, in particular, of African heritage in America. And there is a story that is continuing today. This reluctance, not a reluctance, this is insistence that there should be no equality, no freedom, justice, and equality. Of course, we know tomorrow would be Independence Day, and the nation will celebrate all the rights and privileges accrued to the citizens of a sovereign nation. And it continues. We see the continuum of struggle right through the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to the discussion tomorrow. It will not be part of the discussion, the national consciousness tomorrow, that we still have a bifurcated nation, a nation steeped in a kind of psychotic belief that organizing a society around just indefensible premises, the most egregious one being that on the basis of one's color or ethnicity or some other distinguishing characteristic, you can organize an entire society that way and still insist that you are a democratic society. So this has been the narrative that we've been dealing with, and it goes beyond narrative. We know that it is a reality because these narratives bolster a predetermined reality that there will be a dominant class or group, and there would, of course, be those people who are dominated, subjugated. I chose this question of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 because it is a landmark decision. But I'm introducing the idea not to understand the decision as such, but to understand the need to recalibrate our attitudes about civil rights legislation in general. When the subject is raised and people are talking about civil rights, it's a kind of sanctity, and there should be. This is a very holy war in a way. But it is also a kind of conditioning that tells the entire society, and it's a false one, a false conditioning, but it serves the need of this system that we live in. That while the country might have been myopic and unfair in some instances, there is still this essential value to be fair, to be just, to be right. And these pieces of legislation, individually and collectively, are the manifestation of the intention to be fair. The manifestation by the apparatus of government to do the right thing by those governed. It doesn't take on the smell and the dirt and the funk of war. It looks very neatly packaged. It's very, very democratic. It's very American. It's a really lovely American story about the capacity of the nation to deal with its internal contradictions in a fair and just and appropriate way. And the end result is that we are all better for it. Well, that is the dominating narrative, that the civil rights movement, yes, it's about upheavals and it's about questions of injustice and discrimination and oppression and all of that. But at the same time, it is about the capacity of the system that we live with and live in and live under, the capacity of the system to wrestle with these contradictions and to formulate a just solution. And so when we internalize this narrative, we are literally buying into the big myth, because all societies have one of those. It's like a creation story. This is how we were born. Creation stories are never ugly. They're very noble. We struggled together, and so we have a nation. But of course, the record shows there are people who struggled inordinately more. There are people who paid an inordinately higher price, so that those who dominate can, in fact, remain in power. The first thing I tackled yesterday was this notion, of course, that the civil rights movement, as it is called, began somewhere in the 60s, and it was the, as you know, my father would say from time to time, a curious concatenation of interests, people of all walks of life, essentially coming under the umbrella of the need for a just and fair society, and to challenge the resistant apparatus of government to yield to it, so that we can embrace this notion of Americanism, what it means to be a nation, to bring a sense of wholeness and a sense of healing to the nation. And of course, all these learning opportunities are usually provided by people who have been oppressed. You know, they bring the trade-off is, yes, you know, you've been oppressed, and we've learned so much from your oppression. So we're going to do one or two things to reconstruct ourselves, and that's basically where we have it. Well, here we go. It is important for this society as a whole, but especially African Americans, to reinterpret civil rights struggle. It is not an in and of itself a solution. At best, these are concessions in an ongoing war, if you will. These are concessions. And that's, I'm not suggesting by any means, let me make this very, very clear, do not denigrate the sanctity of these pieces of legislation, because so much, and we know the stories of what went into what preceded these pieces of legislation and the price that people paid, assassinations and lynchings and brutal beatings and the hostile reaction of law enforcement authorities and dogs and water cannon being aimed at citizens and all these indignities. We know those stories. So we cannot in any way desecrate the sanctity of those efforts that yielded these pieces of legislation. But we can't yield to the notion either that they are in and of themselves solutions. They are merely concessions to the dynamic nature of struggle at the time. When we invoke, for example, the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, psychologically we are conditioned to accept that the problem was solved in 1964, you see? And that we are now 50 years away from that point. That is in our distant past, and we have moved on. And we hear, of course, these expressions of the post-racial society and all of this nonsense, as if to suggest to us that the reality that we know, the reality that we are experiencing, is a figment of our imagination, because the record shows that was taken care of in 1964. But I encouraged us yesterday to do some math. And the math that we ought to do is a historical kind of math, math with a certain amount of historicity attached to it. Let's use 1776 as the point of departure. And 1776, because that was, in fact, the Declaration of Independence for the entire nation. This is a whole nation that decided to affirm its sovereignty, to arrogate to itself all these lofty ideals and attributes. And in the name of freedom, justice, and democracy, and liberty, and, you know, all of that stuff, liberty and justice for all, in the name of these ideals, to break free from the colonizer. So if 1776 is a departure point, well, one would imagine if this is happening, if this is going on and there's a consciousness of a need to establish sovereignty for all Americans, and all Americans would automatically have rights, the same rights. They would share the same ideals, the same rights, the same privileges, the same sovereignty. But we know that that's not true. Even as they professed these rights, the so-called founding fathers, whose living, whose wealth was attached to the subjugation of others in slavery, they did not, that was not part of their computations. They did not factor these things in, because the people who they were subjecting to this kind of treatment weren't really people. They were property. They were less than animals. But 1776 is the point I'm choosing to start. And so from 1776, when these rights were affirmed for all men being created equal, according to the document, we see the first evidence of an admission of inequality in 1866, the Civil Rights Act of 1866. And here we therefore must ask the question, if all these rights were inalienable and they accrued to all Americans, then why the need to specify rights for a particular group? There must have been something wrong there. And there was. There was a matter of slavery. It was the industry that supported the sovereignty of the very people professing that all people should have these rights. But it was an interesting thing that it took almost a century to admit this, that there was a need to address this question. From 1776, the first inkling was 1866, with the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1866. And then we saw a number of other initiatives occurring. I must mention, if you're hearing a kind of buzz, there's a great deal of tree cutting going on. We had some accelerated wind yesterday, and they're trying to get various limbs that have fallen away from trees with the tropical storm Arthur attacking the East Coast. So pardon if you hear those buzzes. It's unavoidable. From the Civil Rights Act of 1866, we had other issues. We had the passage of the so-called Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments in particular. But then we had in 1870, 4 years after 1866, we had another Civil Rights Act titled the Civil Rights Act of 1870, which was popularly known as the first Ku Klux Klan Act, followed by the second Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871, and the third Ku Klux Klan Act also in 1871, all of which had to do with tyranny, terrorism against African Americans over this question of wanting to simply be full-fledged citizens of the United States, expressing their right to vote and to participate as full citizens. The tyranny of the Ku Klux Klan necessitated the Civil Rights Acts of 1870 and 1871, but they were called the Civil Rights Acts of 1870 and 1871, although technically they were titled the first, second, and third Ku Klux Klan Acts. In 1875, we had another Civil Rights Act around the issue of public accommodations. In 1957, another Civil Rights Act about voting rights, obstruction of voting rights. In 1964, the Civil Rights Act, as we know, barred discrimination in public accommodations again, in schools, segregation was outlawed, and we had the matter of voting rights. So Civil Rights Acts, as we have known them from 1866 to 1964, have had to do with some interesting themes. Voting, which is an expression of citizenship, and citizenship was not automatically to be assumed as a right for African Americans. The Voting Rights Act had to do with justice, that is to say, freedom from the tyranny of government and the apparatus of government, meaning the law enforcement, the the agents and agencies of government, which was what the Ku Klux Klan really was. These were agents of what they believed to be the reflection of the thinking of government and of the people of the United States. So they were acting in behalf of that mandate to maintain white supremacy. And the Civil Rights Act had to do with equality, this notion of affirming rights that are accorded to all citizens. But when we do the math again, we see that from 1776 to 1866, when the first Civil Rights Act was passed, or where there was a feeling that there was a necessity to articulate the commitment to equality and freedom and liberty and justice and these high ideals, 90 years, a century, pretty much had gone by. And from 1866, when the first Civil Rights Act was passed, to 1964, and we're referencing the Civil Rights Act of 1964, another century had gone by, 98 years to be exact. So, just from the math, one can say that from the dawning of the nation in 1776 to this milestone achieved in 1964, two centuries of deprivation of rights had been occurring, and people had to wait to see how these things were going to be dealt with, and we know that they haven't been resolved. So what is this thing then about civil rights and the civil rights struggle and these civil rights laws? And this is why I'm saying we have to rethink and recalibrate our attitudes about that, because we have to see them, we have to see civil rights acts as merely concessions in an ongoing war for freedom, justice, and equality. It's like if you find a very strong pair of hands around your neck choking you, choking literally the life out of you, whatever alleviates the situation that takes the pressure off your neck, you'll take it. Because in the end, your survival is primary. That's the thing that is going to inform all of your actions, your absolute desire to survive. So if you get a little bit of pressure taken off your neck, you will be happy for it, because it is in keeping with your primary objective, which is to survive. But the hands are still around your neck, and you are aware of that, so that even when the pressure is alleviated a little bit, you are still aware that the hands are around your neck. And you're still aware that it is quite possible that the pressure will increase again. And that's how you have to see it. These are not solutions to the problem. These are by no means the magic recipe for democracy. They are merely the concessions that a system is making, because that's the power equation remains exactly the same. It is the system that decides how much it will yield, what it is willing to give. Solutions as manifestations of a desire to create a whole nation, we cannot lose sight of the fact that the power equation does not change at all. When a system can give you freedom, it isn't quite freedom, is it? when it is in a position to allow you a certain amount of latitude, you can't claim that latitude as part of your innate power, can you? But we are lulled into this thinking that civil rights and civil rights struggle in and of themselves are solutions, and they're not. And we are lulled into believing that we can't move beyond it, because those are not just the solutions, those are the ultimate solutions. Those are the results of how far the limits, those have tested the limits of this question of what are to be the rights of all citizens. And of course, that's not the case at all. So how do we recalibrate our thinking about civil rights struggle and the civil rights legislation and attitudes towards civil rights? The first thing, again, is to see that this struggle, the civil rights struggle, as it's called, is not going to end anytime soon. Because the premise of the struggle is meant to be eternal and binding. And that is, in this land, there is a thing called white supremacy. It will prevail, and the apparatus of government has all the instruments at its disposal to impose its will in such a way so as to create that schism in our society, to impose it as de facto life. That's how we live. Now, a lot of energy and money and psychology go into conditioning us to believe that we're all one, that we're all in this together. And yes, to some degree, yes, we are. We can't deny that. I mean, just look at the reaction to FIFA. And when the Olympics are on and people are rooting for the country and you take on the sense of national pride. But I do believe that it is hard to deny that when we look at our society, this is a permanent threat. This line of demarcation based and predicated on racial division is a permanent thread in the fabric of American life. To think otherwise is foolhardy, in my view. That is the reality of our condition. Number two, understand that there is in struggle the business of concession, and you have to deal with it as a reality until you reach a point of critical mass where your power, your aggregate power, allows you to confront certain things on the basis of power. We're not nearly there. And it is because we just don't understand the inherent power of our power. We don't get it. That's the psychological burden that we carry. We talk about all the things that need to be done, which require power to get them done. But we're terrified of affirming and accruing and consolidating power. We automatically, psychologically yield that to the system of control. We recognize them to be the eternal power. And so we are constantly in reactive mode. When you take a look at the objective conditions within African American communities across the nation, you see this as the common theme. How could, with so many people, how could your communities be in such a mess? With such available power, how is it that you have all this chaos going on in your community? Just about everything is failing or in some state of disarray. The institutions that you would typically lean on to solidify your community, they are in various stages of decay. And the power within your community actually is dictated from outside of your community. So there's a psychological misfit going on there, because you have the numbers, but you don't have the power commensurate with your numbers. And that is precisely the reason that there has been a lack of progress. Because the system understands that very well. They control the community. They control the power within the community. The third is to understand that this awful habit of romanticizing things. We have romanticized the civil rights movement. We've made it a kind of, we've infantilized it. All these lovely, obedient people. When the narrative that should be created within the community itself is that these were warriors. These were fighters. These people went to the mat for these concepts and ideals. Instead, we see, you know, that we shall overcome and people holding hands and all this stuff, this emphasis on the Gandhian principle. And I'm not saying this to deprecate any of it. I'm saying these are the methods used to condition people to accept their impotence and their lack of will to do the things that are well within their power to do, to immobilize you through psychological conditioning of total implacability. You know, you there and you are at the will and mercy of whatever it is they throw at you, whether it's the dogs or the water cannon or the police and the batons or whatever it is. You take it all because you're suffering in the noble tradition of Christ. When in fact there should be an aggression within the community about what it is owed and long overdue, considering it has waited at this point 238 years to get basics done and cannot wait anymore. The community is not only in crisis, it is in meltdown. And if it is recognized that that is what it is, then the response is completely inappropriate. This idea that we have all the time in the world, this idea is that we can wait. But of course, we're taking our cues from the people who control us. So our orientation is bad. Our thinking is stinking. And our communities are falling apart because we have failed to correctly understand and interpret this reality of our struggle, the civil rights struggle. Everybody else has gotten the point, and they have taken the lessons demonstrated in the civil rights struggle and used it to very good advantage to make certain gains in their constituencies. But we have to rid ourselves of this romantic notion that A, it is a past life, B, it is about great ideals of suffering, so that we suffer and take on the inordinate burden of redemption, the moral redemption of our oppressors. And if we love them hard enough and make the kinds of incalculable sacrifices to demonstrate how much we love them, though they hate us, that if we love them hard enough, they will change. They will become human. The whole struggle of African Americans in the civil rights, so-called civil rights movement, has been to humanize the society, to make it behave like everybody is a human being. The basics. Treat me with respect, I treat you with respect. We could all live together. We share this land, and let's learn how to behave. And that we all can prosper. We all can pursue our goals and dreams and aspirations. But of course, that's not what it is. So we have this psychotic, schizophrenic world that is telling us one story and pumping out a narrative that we have grabbed onto and we commemorate. You know, it should drive people to anger that 50 years, that we could say so casually, well, we are observing the 50th anniversary of the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That should really annoy people. It means half a century has gone by, and yet the benefit cannot be quantified. It should be very upsetting to the African-American community that 238 years have gone by. And if we understand in the United States this whole notion of generational wealth, and what is the accrued loss? What is the loss that has accrued to the African American community that has been sustained from 238 years? And I'm just again going from the year 1776. I'm not even calculating from the 1500s and the 1400s and the 1600s. I'm not even dealing with that. I'm going strictly from the point of 1776. What is the cumulative damage that has been sustained from this kind of political, social, economic neglect and oppression 238 years? And while you're busy suffering for 238 years, referencing these sporadic concessions that the system gives you, here, we'll pass an act. As of today, you should be able to stay at a hotel. Oh, we are so grateful because, of course, your whole life is about wanting to stay at a hotel. What is the cumulative damage, the cumulative loss, the cumulative pain and suffering and deprivation? And that is what should inform political consciousness and political action. And here I want to make a very important point. This is not the work of African Americans alone. This is America's work. How do we create a just society? this notion that, well, it's the people who are affected, let them fix it. The people who have been affected have always been fixing it. They've had to fight to get it fixed. But this is not their job alone. I don't see within the progressive community, I don't see in the white world, a consciousness about the obligation to keep this conversation going and to keep this, these very ideals on point, at front and center of the way we calibrate our success as a society as a whole. I don't see in the white world that there is an obligation, a duty to contribute to the forward thrust of society at this level. Quite the opposite. I see that there is a thinking, let them do whatever it is they need to do, as long as I am reasonably secure in my understanding, in my reality, in my world, that I do enjoy the rights and privileges of the people who are in power. I'm okay with that. Everything else is pure theory to me. It's all a haze to me. But I am sufficiently comforted by the fact of having membership in the power group. And that's as far as my consciousness goes. I have no desire beyond that to talk about how do we construct society? How do we make it more just? How do we alleviate suffering? How do we confront systems of government that deliberately pose impediments to progress as the ongoing work of a citizen? You will notice that much of the focus of the Civil Rights Act had to do with voting. And yet voting is an expression of citizenship. And yet citizenship is something that the system never intended African Americans to have. But voting is important because voting is strategically used to maintain their power. And we talked about this just earlier on in the week when the case in Mississippi of the U.S. Senator Thad Cochran, a Republican in a pretty tough runoff race, who saw his political fortunes in courting the votes of black Democrats, and they gave it to him. But I was also it was also important to point out that we were in 2014 repeating the same kinds of civil war, you know, deep south type of tactics with respect to the vote, but we could not overlook the fact that Jesse Jackson did the exact same thing. Using the power of the black vote and then usurping that power and putting it right on the auction block to the highest bidder as an independent contractor. You see? The thinking is stinking. So as we approach this day tomorrow, the 238th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence and the Declaration of Sovereignty as an American nation, let us also take a look at the parallel struggle, the 50th anniversary of which we celebrated or began to take note of yesterday in our conversation, this notion of the Civil Rights Act. Because all these rights that have been accrued, or supposed rights that we have accrued, are negotiable. They are conditional. They are given by the same system that can take them away, and that has developed multiple ways of doing so. These are all civil rights given as concessions. They're not at all about your natural rights, which is what the power elite operates on. They operate on the notion of their natural right. So civil rights are by no means absolute. They're conditional, they're all negotiable, and can be removed at any time. We falsely believe that these rights have corresponding duties by the government to protect and enforce these rights. You really have to re-examine that false notion. The rights extended to us are based on varying interpretations of what it means to be a human being in the United States. We are, as African Americans, of the grouping not seen as human beings. Simply the passage of time will erase that thinking? I don't think so. And we see, in fact, with every gain by these civil rights acts, there has been a backlash and a re-entrenchment, in fact, of the racial codas that permeate all aspects of life in the United States. So your wonderful Civil Rights Act of 1964 literally was rendered null and void within a matter of years. And here we are in 2014 discussing voting rights again, discussing all the basics that were supposedly fought and won. So the civil rights struggle and these civil rights acts are not to be seen as solutions in and of themselves. They are to be seen simply as a pragmatic response by a system to the intermittent challenges that confronted it. But at every turn, even as we had these pieces of legislation passed, the power equation remains exactly the same, in some cases even more entrenched. The power equation simply is that there is no power by the people who are oppressed. And even in granting certain concessions, it is the power of the system that prevails, not the will of the people confronting it. So those are my thoughts. Examine this whole issue of civil rights struggle. Get out of this romantic notion that it's about people holding hands and singing, "We Shall Overcome." It actually is more about coming to the realization that we are overcome. And it is way past time to recommit to the objectives set out so long ago, which is to affirm the power and authority to be sovereign within a sovereign nation, to affirm those rights that they talk about so idealistically. All men are not created equal. not in the United States. But what can happen is some kind of a workable operation, a workable plan, a kind of detente. But that requires the consolidation of power. And yet our power grid is actually in the hands of the system that is oppressing us. And that is, I keep talking about the Democratic Party all the time. How can you amass independent political power when all of your chips are within the Democratic Party, practically? How could you confront a system that you are aiding and abetting in oppressing you? You got to rethink these things. So it's just a wake-up call today to get us to rethink this notion, again, to revere the efforts made in our collective behalf to honor the sanctity of those efforts, but not to be in any way convinced that these pieces of legislation are in and of themselves a solution to a problem. No, it's not. Nor is it meant to remove the focus of what the problem really is. We have a system of white supremacy in the United States. That's the problem. And there have to be other and more dynamic ways of responding to it, so that we take the lessons of the struggle of the civil rights movement, which again, I go back to 1866, not 1964. We take from those struggles what we need to put together more intelligent responses that suit the needs better, that achieve the goals better, that have better strategy behind them. And we also insist that this is a shared burden. This is not black people's burden alone. White America has got to account for its absence from this fight. The progressive community has been distracted and telling us about what everything else ought to be, what the fight ought to be, but there's no commitment on an ongoing basis to this whole notion, just the basic notion of creating a just society. They think, well, that's those folks' problem. Let them take care of that. We'll do the heavy thinking. We just want you to do the heavy lifting. So that's my message to you today. I thank you for the opportunity to present these ideas and hope that they are resonating. You will tell me how if you drop me a note at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Hugh Treece Lead. Just want to let you know that tomorrow there will be a day off at PRN, but I'm going to be very purposeful by recasting an interview with Professor Gerald Horn that I think everybody needs to hear. It is about his book, an extraordinary insight into this independence, revolution for independence. The book is titled The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. It is a profound book. It is extraordinary, and his insights for the first time, I mean, it just turns this whole notion about objecting to Britain's control, makes it, I mean, he tells the truth about what really motivated this drive to break with Britain in 1776. All right, so thank you so much. Coming up next, and you want to keep it right here, is Mike Fader with Occupied Territory America. Thank you, a pleasure and a privilege, and I mean that, to be in your company. A prayer, it's praise, a lament. That-